Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday, from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. AI will never be outrightly rude or racist, but that doesn't mean it doesn't formulate racist opinions based on harmful stereotypes. This covert racism has major implications, from hiring to legal decisions. Today, we're talking about covert racism in AI with Sarush Vosuki, Associate Professor of Computer Science at Dartmouth University. Welcome to All Sides, Sarush.
Thank you for having me.
So just like people can say they aren't racist, but still hold racist ideas or racist opinions, can AI do the same thing? Tell me how you found out about AI and racism.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, a lot of times when you're interacting with AI models, they don't come out and explicitly express a racist view or something stereotypical or biased. But what you see in a lot of cases is when the AI model can infer some information about the user's demographics or background, whatever they may be, then the responses that they generate or provide to the user will differ depending on whatever demographic they think the user is. So for instance, even without the user explicitly mentioning anything about their demographic, an AI model can, based on the user's interests or occupation or anything, a lot of information like that, the AI model can actually infer to a fairly high degree of accuracy the general demographic buckets the user might fall under. So, the age range, gender, race, whether the user is a rural or urban user, and all of this information can then be used in the way the model responds to a user's request. The user would never know this is happening, but our study has shown that this indeed happens at pretty high frequency.
Yeah, and the studies say AI is covertly racist. So can you tell me the difference between overt and covert racism? Like, how do you distinguish between the two?
Absolutely. So overt racism would be if the AI model comes out and just says something, generates like some text that is just explicitly, unquestionably racist. So that would be overt racism. Covert racism would be basically what I described, which is the AI model not saying anything racist and not wanting to be racist, but these models are really, at the end of the day, statistical models. So they just repeat what they've seen in their training data. And they're trained on a lot of data collected from the web. So whatever stereotypes and biases are present on the web, and we all know that there's a lot of that abound on the web, whatever it is available there will be used as training data for these models and will be covertly affecting the way the model responds to a user based on what the model thinks the user's demographics are. So that would be a definition of covert racism.
So LLMs, large language models, make racist decisions sometimes you found based on how people talk. So how do these LLMs judge people based on how they speak? Were they trained using a certain type of the way people speak, and anything different it impacts it?
Yes, basically they were trained on the web. And when I say the web, I mean literally all of the web. So they're trained on vast amount of information collected from the internet. And, a lot of that information comes from social media platforms or forums where people sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes tend to show stereotypical and maybe racist views. And so those views are going to be reflected in the way the AI thinks. Again, not because the AI is designed to be racist, it's just what the data reflects. Now, an example of a simple example would be, for instance, if you start, as people may know, these AI models have a pretty long-term memory, meaning that they keep track of the conversation you have with them over long periods of time. So let's say one day you mentioned to your ChatGPT model or some other AI model that you like to, I don't know, play basketball, versus another person that says they like to play hockey, for instance, right? Something very simple, just what they like to play. Based on the data that the model has seen, it's likely, and I picked these two examples because we actually shown this to be true. The model is likely to infer that the person who likes basketball is more likely to be from an urban area. The person who likes hockey is more likely to be from a rural area. And so just based on that inference that it makes based on the kind of sports the user likes to play, later on, if you then ask it about, let's say, some kind of a health question, it might give you a different answer based on this inferred demographic. So it might give a different answer for to the person who it thinks is from a rural area versus the person that it thinks is from an urban area.
Interesting. Yeah. According to the study, speakers of African American English dialect, which in the study, AAE dialect, are known to experience discrimination in housing, education, employment, racial sentencing. And now AI is demonstrating covert racism when it comes to that same dialect. How does that happen? How did you figure that out?
Yeah, so this African American speech, as you called it, AAE, it's been studied way before our lab started studying it. So this has been studied in the past in the context of automated moderation on social media platforms. So a lot of these automated tools that are designed to, for instance, remove toxic language, a lot of times they consider African American speech as toxic language, even if whatever the person is saying is completely benign, just because of the way it's formed, a lot of these models will think it's toxic. So this is before like LLMs even became a thing. So the study of AAE or African American speech is has a long history. Now, in the context of large language models, the problem has been exacerbated quite a lot, and it's not just African American speech. In fact, as I said, any type of stereotype or bias that you may come across on the internet will be by default, like by definition, reflected in these models. So these models really are kind of they work on a garbage in, garbage out principle. And what they're getting in is the internet, the entire internet. And so anything that you may think that is stereotypical that shows itself on the internet will be to some level reflected in the output of this model.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about covert racism in AI with Sarush Vasuki, an associate professor of computer science at Dartmouth University. When asked to describe people of color, AI came up with adjectives like brilliant and passionate. But how does AI go from saying positive adjectives like that about people of color to making judgments reminiscent of like Jim Crow era stereotypes? How does both happen in AI?
So it's not really about Jim Crow type stereotypes. It's more about maybe responding differently to different demographics or people. Let's say if a white person asks a question, they might get a different answer than if a person of color asks the same question. Now, which answer is better? That's a separate question. But the fact that they do get different answers, that is, I think, problematic. These are scenarios where the demographic should not matter. So, understandably, if the question relates let's say the racial background of the user, then yes, it makes sense that the models would generate different answers. But for even interactions where the demographic or the racial background should not matter, you get these different answers. And so this is quite problematic in certain domains where obviously people's lives could be at stake, specifically, for example, healthcare domain. If someone is asking a health question, and the model thinks that they're white and they get a different answer than the person who the model thinks they're a person of color, that is, as you can imagine, quite problematic.
Has AI always been racist, or has it grown more so over time?
That's a really good question. So these models are not racist by definition. So they're not built to be racist. They're just mathematical models. They are just a good, they reflect whatever they see as part of their training. And so what they are is basically you can think of it as a mirror that's being held up, and they're reflecting whatever they find on the internet. And so the models themselves aren't racist, they're just mathematical models. And they're definitely not designed to be racist, but the data that they're trained on is quite not just racist, you know, but like bias towards, for example, male, like you get different answers for male versus female users, you know, different racial backgrounds, and so on. A really good example of the male versus female scenario would be, for instance, just saying that I'm a student interested in, you know, pursuing healthcare careers. What should I do? And if the model thinks you are female, based on the previous interactions, it might suggest it's more likely to suggest for you to go into nursing versus if it thinks you are a man, it's more likely to suggest becoming a doctor, for instance. And so this is an example of you know, different kinds of responses that you get based on the demographic. And again, the models are not racist. The data they're trained on is racist. And so to answer your question, whether they're becoming more or less racist, I think the question is whether the internet is becoming more or less racist, because the models just reflect what is found on the internet.
Interesting. Yeah, so using that nurse versus doctor example, so there's just more on the internet about women being nurses and not very many men being nurses. And that's where it gets that answer from.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, so AI has been used to screen job applications, and it screens the job applicant's social media accounts during the hiring process for people. It screens resumes. It makes decisions on who gets interviewed before a human even sees anything. So I thought AI was supposed to make the job application process less biased. Is that not true?
To some levels, it is less biased in that it removes the potential for human bias, but it introduces a different kind of bias. So it's re removing human bias that you would get when you have human interviewers and recruiters that have been well studied. And it replaces it with this other type of kind of covert, harder to catch bias. And in some ways, I would say that's worse because it's less out in the open. And so people might not even realize that these models are actually making biased decisions. I have to say, though, just anecdotally, the undergraduate students that I've interacted with over the last couple of years, who've been applying to jobs and have AI algorithms kind of screen the resume, the vast majority of them hate the current system. Like they're not, they do not think it's you know, an improvement over recruitment compared to, for example, previous years where AI models were less frequently used. Obviously, that's anecdotal. But as I said, in terms of bias, I think we just replace one type of bias with another, potentially more dangerous type of bias because it's hidden.
So yeah, so if you think the computer, for lack of a, you know, if you think the computer is doing a good job, then and it, you know, who's to say whether it is or not, I guess, right?
Exactly. And especially if these biases are covert and hard to catch, they can only be caught if they're studied systematically at a very large scale, which is what some of the stuff that my lab and other lab work on is exactly that.
So, what would you say are the consequences of AI being covertly racist? What would you tell people to be worried about?
Well, the most, I think, important consequences are when these systems are deployed in real life scenarios, for example, for health or you mentioned job recruitment or a lot of financial institutions now use these models, for example, for approving loans and other kinds of applications. So I think first being aware of the problem is very important. It is the covert nature of the problem does make it hidden and harder to catch. And it gives people a false sense of security that, hey, it's an AI model. There's no way it can be biased. And unfortunately, the AI model is just, as I said, reflecting human biases it sees on the internet. And so there's real danger that people are going to be complacent and think that this is not an issue, but it actually is an issue. So I would say the most important thing is for people to be aware of the fact that these models are not some kind of you know, post-racist or post-biased, you know, system that they don't have to worry about. So they should be aware of the potential issues.
Can anything be done to fix it besides sweeping, like doing a clean sweep of the entire internet?
You know, so that's a really good question. The clean sweep would work, which obviously it is not scalable. The issue we're seeing is actually unfortunately inherent to the way AI models currently work. So large language models, the reason why we get such great performance out of them is because they have been trained on a vast amount of information from the internet. And the data is so large that they allow for this, the models to perform really well, but that also means that we cannot manually audit and clean the data. It's out of the, it's just not possible. And so it becomes really a question of performance versus bias, not even bias, performance versus, I would just call it antisocial behavior, right? So you could curate a very clean data set, but that's gonna be a very small data set. And so the performance of the model is gonna drop. Or if you have a very large data set, the performance of the model is gonna go up, but you cannot really audit it or clean it. And so it's going to be a biased model. This is an inherent flaw with the current state of AI, which is really reliant on scale. Both large models, a lot of compute power. I'm sure people have heard about all of the data centers and computing centers that have been built for AI. So large amount of compute power and large amount of data. And that's the current generation of AI. And so unless there is a new, not unless, I know there are labs, including my own lab, that are working on this. So until there is a new generation of AI models that come out that are less reliant on data, less reliant on scale, the problem is going to persist. The best we could do, and this is what a lot of companies have started doing, is kind of band-aid solutions, which is trying to put guardrails for these models. But these are really nothing more than, you know, kind of post hoc, like after the models have been trained, they're going to be biased. Let's put some guardrails around it so that they're not going to be, you know, like overtly biased in like a lot of cases, but it doesn't really remove the underlying problem that these models have with covert racism and bias.
Just to end on, you lead the Minds, Machines, and Society group at Dartmouth. And can you talk a bit about what this organization studies, you know, the goals to make AI more socially aware?
Yeah, so we are really interested in, I would say at the very high level, we have two threads. One is working on this next generation AI models that I just was talking about. So making models less reliant on data and more similar to how humans reason. So using more structure and kind of abstract reasoning and less reliant on just looking at massive amount of data, which is what current models do. So that's kind of one thread. It's kind of a long-term, high-risk area of research. And then the other thread is looking at current models that we have, specifically LLMs, and trying to develop tools for first interpreting or understanding how they work. These models are black boxes. Even people who design these models don't really know how they work. So building tools to understand their inner workings, that's one of the things we do. And then also building tools to measure, and more importantly, mitigate the antisocial behaviors of these models. So the covert racism is one example of such antisocial behavior. There's a lot more, for instance, hallucinations, like making things up, toxicity or like toxic language and so on and so forth. These are all things that these AI models do exhibit, and we try to create tools to measure them and then mitigate them. Again, these are all band-aid solutions. Hopefully next generation AI models will not have these problems.
Well, whenever you fix it and you save the world, you come back and let us know, okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay. We've been talking about covert racism in AI with Sarush Vasuki, an associate professor of computer science at Dartmouth University. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to be talking about the environmental impact of streaming services. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. When thinking about environmental issues, most people don't look at the smaller things in our lives, even though they may have a huge impact. Streaming services have become one of the most dominant and popular forms of media consumption, since Netflix and Spotify revolutionized how we watch TV and movies and how we listen to our favorite music. These services are not without their downsides, though, as they grow, how does their environmental impact grow with them? Joining us now is Kyle Devine, a professor of environmental studies and dean of graduate studies at the University of Winnipeg. He's the author of a 2019 book called Decomposed, The Political Ecology of Music, and his newest book is Recomposed, Music, Climate, Crisis, and Change, and it comes out in July. Thanks so much for being here, Kyle.
Pleasure.
So how does the back end of streaming actually work? You know, what goes into Netflix and Spotify users being able to stream? Are we talking big computers, big data centers like we hear about all the time?
The short answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. The digital infrastructure of streaming is large. It's extremely complicated. It's constantly changing, developing, evolving, becoming more efficient and growing. So anything I can say about sort of how streaming works is going to be an oversimplification. Mm-hmm. But you can think of it in terms of three stages. There are data centers or server farms, as they're commonly called, where, you know, content is stored. And then there are delivery networks or transmission networks that take the content from those data centers to a third phase, which is more like a local access network where people like you and I would get things like music onto our phones or our computers, right? Mm-hmm. That's the very, very basic overview of how that works. And, you know, the basic reason that all of that stuff matters from an environmental perspective is that digital files, even though they're invisible, they are physical things. They take up space. And they require energy to store, to process, to download, and things like that. And depending on where you are, a lot of different ways of providing that energy will make certain claims on the environment.
Yeah, I think that a lot of us spent a lot of time just saying, oh, I don't understand the cloud. It's just there, right? But more so lately, we're understanding more about the power and the need behind these because of all of these data centers that are growing because of AI, right? So tell me about how much traffic streaming constitutes compared to what we hear about all the time, that AI is sucking up all of our energy. But what does streaming do?
Right. So, I mean, the energy demands of AI are growing and growing and growing, in addition to land use and you know, water demands and things like that. I guess the best thing the most accurate information I can provide is that information, communications, technology, that sector, mm-hmm. contributes something like 2% or 4% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, video streaming is a part of it. Music streaming is a part of it, but a smaller part. And they're not their contributions are not as large as AI, mm-hmm. And things like that. But it all is growing. And, you know, Spotify, Netflix, YouTube, even things like Pornhub, contribute billions of hours of streaming every year, mm-hmm. right? And that's where we get that 2-4% contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions.
How does streaming compare to other forms of watching and listening? Like, does the footprint of making like a vinyl record or making a CD outweigh the cost of streaming a song?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. And I tend to resist comparisons like that a little bit. And I'll give you some comparisons, but I'll explain why I like to at least preface that with a little resistance or skepticism, which is that, you know, comparing should I use Spotify or should I use Tidal or a different streaming service or should I stream all my music or, you know, have vinyl records tends to focus our thoughts about environmental issues inward, mm-hmm. and it can risk turning environmental action into basically shopping decisions, right? What kind of car should I drive? What kind of music should I listen to, or how should I listen to that music? What kind of light bulbs should I have? And there's nothing wrong with that. But as a way of confronting the sort of scale of the environmental issues that we face, it's had a history. Its history is of it has a limited effect, right? Mm. But as we can make these comparisons, right? So to compare you or I streaming an album versus buying that album on an old-fashioned record made out of polyvinyl chloride, a type of plastic, there's really no comparison, right? Streaming that album once for you or I is vastly more efficient than buying that album on that, buying that old-fashioned album on plastic or even CDs or cassettes, probably. So from an environmental perspective, in that one-to-one level, streaming is much, much, much more efficient, much mm-hmm. better for the environment. But one-to-one comparisons on some level also miss the point, right? Because what streaming is doing is not you or I streaming an album, right? That it's an entire industry that's figured out a way of offering more music to more people more of the time. And that's what contributes to those billions of hours of listening. And that's where you get a kind of aggregate environmental effect, even though the individual acts, when you compare them on that one-to-one level, are much more efficient in the digital world.
Okay, so if I want to try to save the environment, and you're saying that buying the different light bulbs isn't helping. Yeah, I know it was just an example, but I was like, oh no, my light bulbs. But are the streaming companies, is there something the streaming companies can do differently to help with their environmental impact? Or is this just the way it's going to be until we figure out how to do something different with all this data?
Yeah, I mean that's the big question, mm-hmm. and it's a very important and good one. We can talk about a little bit more maybe about what individuals can do, because it's not a sort of empty or hopeless realm if it's treated in a certain way. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, going out there and trying to figure out which are the more efficient or long lasting light bulbs. I'm not against that. I also always, when I talk about this stuff, say, I subscribe to a streaming service. Mm-hmm. I have a very modest collection of records and CDs. I've played in bands that have released records and that have their music on streaming services and things. So I'm not coming into this on a sort of moral high horse or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in there with everybody trying to figure out what we can do as individuals. In terms of what the wider streaming industry is doing, there's lots of important things going on. You know, streaming companies make appointments at vice president levels in things like sustainability. They publish, in the interest of transparency, annual environmental social governance reporting that will talk about, you know, their own energy usage in their offices and how much energy it costs them to conduct their business. And they will also, a company like Spotify, and I don't mean to pick on Spotify, but, you know, they will point to how much energy they use in connection with the people who store their data, because they don't do that themselves. They sort of subcontract that out. So that transparency is an important step. There's also really interesting work going on with something like the music, what's it called again? Music Sustainability Alliance. There's also the Music Climate Pact. And these are sort of cross-industry initiatives to figure out, you know, the best environmental path forward for the music industry. And, you know, it's important because these are companies that are locked in competition on one level, but they are also collaborating to figure out, okay, how do we measure? How do we best measure carbon emissions from streaming? How do we best assess the life cycle of products like vinyl records and things like that? So there is this interesting concerted effort, you know, going on. It is, I don't want to say undercut, but, you know, when the sort of economic arrangement that we exist in has created this problem, there are some questions about whether the same economic system that created that problem can actually get us out of it. But that gets us into some very, very big questions. But there's lots of really great stuff going on there. It's also worth mentioning that services like Spotify will mention that they are hosting podcasts and musicians who use their platforms to raise awareness and who use their voices to, incite or ignite kind of, climate emotions in people and things like that. And, I have additional thoughts on that too, but it's not nothing. And all of that is going on and all of it matters.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the environmental costs of streaming with Kyle Devine, professor of environmental studies at the University of Winnipeg. So in your 2019 book that I mentioned called Decomposed, you show that recorded music has always been a significant exploiter of both natural and human resources, and that its reliance on these resources is more problematic than ever today. But now you have a new book coming out in July called Recomposed, so Music, Climate, Crisis, and Change. So how did you advance the themes in your book of what you looked at in 2019 versus in this new book?
Right. So that 2019 book was focused on the record industry, and it was a kind of environmental history of the record industry going from around 1900 right up until the rise of streaming after around the year 2015. And that book, there was this common story that you'd hear at the time, which was that the history of recorded music, especially when it went digital, was this history of dematerialization, right? That we used to have these precious physical objects that we would listen to, and now poof, it's all gone. It's all up there in the cloud, and it's intangible. And that was followed closely by the thought that streaming music probably didn't have much environmental impact. And that was around 2012. I started doing that work, and it was around that time you were starting to see reports on the environmental toll of a Netflix binge and things like that, right? And so I knew that music must be part of that picture, and I went and I tried to sort of look at the environmental impact of streaming and to compare that with earlier recording formats. And what I found was that despite that sort of common sense idea that the history of recorded music was this history from physical discs to invisible digits up there in the cloud and these pristine data streams, if you looked at it from an emissions perspective, recorded music was probably more taxing on the planet in the age of streaming than it was at any point in its previous history, at the point with regard to any previous format. And so that was that book. And that a lot of people reached out after they read that book and they said, hey, we heard that, there's an issue here. Check out what I'm doing, right? I'm making records out of sugar, or I'm making solar powered stereos, or I'm trying to make a streaming service that's cooled because it's tucked inside a mountain and is powered by geothermal energy. And so I met all these interesting people doing all this great work. They're custom carbon calculators, climate credentials for the music sector, investment initiatives geared toward environmental themes that focused on musicians. So eventually I sort of collected and met enough people and collected enough of these inspiring stories that I thought, okay, I'm writing a book about the sort of what do we do question. And so the book profiles people doing that good work in the music industry, trying, basically asking these questions, how do we make music more sustainable?
So I, not to give away everything in your book, but what should people do? Like, what should someone like I do? I have, I have Netflix, I have Apple TV, I have a music service. Am I a part of the problem? How can I be a part of the solution?
Right. So, I mean, we're all part of that, right? We are all wrapped up or caught up in this, and that's no one's fault. That's no individual's fault. And I don't think that feeling guilty about that is a good starting point. Or for some people, if they do feel guilty and that gets them out there trying to change things, that's fine. For me, I don't ever want to make people feel guilty about existing in the world, right? and one way to start addressing these issues is to say, okay, well, I'm going to try and buy records made out of sugar, or I've heard that this streaming service is committed to net zero or using 100% renewable energy, and we can make these kinds of consumer choices. What I think, and so that's the basic gesture of this new book. is that old improvisational comedy rule of thumb, which is yes and, right? Not no but. That tends to shut the scene down, but yes and. And so the book says yes to all of this excellent and interesting and inspiring work that's going on in music to make music more sustainable. It says, and what else can, what other conversations can we have? What other things can we do? You know, and one of the most important things, you know, for everyday people like you and I is not just to think of ourselves as individual consumers, right? To think of what we can do if we get together, not just to make music more sustainable, but to sort of work with music, if that's an important part of our lives for some people like me, to work with it in order to shine the light on where responsibility for a lot of these problems really lies, right? Because music is small potatoes, right, in the big picture of environmental issues. And so, you know, some people, to give concrete examples, some people, when they look at the issues with streaming and AI and all of this, they say, band together and debate or sometimes fight and resist the expansion of data centers. And I think there's a story in the US in New Jersey where a group of people successfully recently blocked the construction of a data center. That might be one way forward. There's also a story that I like in South Korea with the, you know, the home of K-pop and a long tradition of kind of consumers banding together and consumer activism. And basically, consumers in South Korea, music fans in South Korea, said to their biggest streaming service, which is called Melon, they said they had a campaign essentially. And I think part of it was basically saying, look, if you don't commit to 100% renewable energy, we're going to stop using your service. And that Melon in recent years has committed, based on that campaign partly, to switching over to 100% renewable energy by 2030, I think. You know, so there are concrete things. We can make individual choices about which products we consume, and we can get together and you know, shine the light where the responsibility really lies. And I think that's the biggest and that I try to add to all of the yeses in the book.
We've been talking about the environmental impact of streaming with Kyle Devine, professor of environmental studies at the University of Winnipeg. Thank you so much for your time today, Kyle.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we are going to talk about Roblox, which is in hot water over children's safety. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. One of the most popular online games, Roblox, has been in hot water because of its seeming neglect for children's safety. And one small step for mankind is one giant leap for Apple and Android phones. NASA has recently approved modern phones to go into orbit with astronauts. Joining us to discuss this and more is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with Roblox. So Los Angeles County has sued the gaming company behind Roblox for concerns over children's safety measures. What is the biggest problem with Roblox's current safety measures? Are they just not good enough?
Yes, it is essentially that they are not good enough. And the problem is that this is, you can go back, 10 years, and this has been an ongoing conversation. Roblox is by far and away the most popular free game that kids play. It is very specifically targeted at folks who are under 16. It has a lot of built-in chat and communications tools that are largely unmonitored. There are previous versions of this platform that had no filter for language or content type, and there are Tools that allow you to filter out certain kinds of games within Roblox that only certain age groups can join. But it's really easy to bypass those limitations and put really inappropriate content in, games that kids that don't know what they're, don't know that that's what they're getting when they click are a part of this. This is a really odd anecdote, but I was traveling recently and there was a hotel, a Marriott hotel that I was staying at, and there was a kid in the lobby who had hijacked one of the like printer computers and was playing Roblox on it to a point that like staff had to come and like remove them because the parent wasn't there. Like this is an incredibly popular game that if you have kids under 15, they probably either play on a regular basis or have friends who do.
Roblox, I'll just say personally, Roblox drives me crazy. If my son asks me one more time to let him have it, and I say no, because I don't trust the chat. I just don't trust it at all. So one of the biggest problems, though, with introducing more verification for its users is that it can compromise the privacy of adults, too. So what's the dilemma there? Is Roblox says if it makes it safer, then adults can't use it? Or what's the deal?
Right. This is there are kind of two different sides to the conversation that are happening right now. The first is, if you create verification gates all throughout the process so that you know exactly who is doing what and when, then that removes anonymity in a way that is viewed by a lot of people as kind of a net negative. If you encrypt everything, you run into something very similar to another issue that Meta is currently facing, where once encryption has been turned on something, it is impossible to look in and see that inappropriate conversations are happening, which means fewer reports of those inappropriate conversations are happening because the evidence is not there to follow up on. So there this is a complicated topic, and the core of the issue is putting the onus on the person using the tools instead of making the tools safer. By Roblox taking the personal responsibility and frankly paying moderators to go into these games and determine where their viability or their age appropriateness is not something that's being discussed as a possible solution on behalf of Roblox, despite being a company that makes an enormous amount of money on this game.
Well, what's the deal with LA County? Because they're also responsible for the lawsuit against Meta that you mentioned that involves social media addiction. So is LA just taking the lead on all of this?
That really seems to be the case. The lawsuit from LA County, it is specifically claiming that there is, kind of false advertising on behalf of the safety tools that are currently being used, which Roblox is quick to point to when asked for comment, that there is, unfair competition as a result of the exploitation or as a result of the advertising that is currently being used because they are able to, to make these claims. That their games are safe when there is very little evidence to back that up. And what what LA County itself calls a systemic sexual exploitation across the United States.
There's a trial going on right now related to Meta. Are there any updates on that case? I know it's probably going to be a long one.
This is a really long one. This is something, it got a little more attention last week because Mark Zuckerberg was personally there to kind of give testimony. What this case really comes down to is that it's kind of two different forks of the same monster. The first is, kind of the addictive quality of social media tools, specifically Instagram in this case, that Instagram is built from the ground up to be addicting, and that this is something that Meta as a company has known for quite some time and has done very little to bypass. And the case itself includes what appears to be quite a bit in the way of documentation to suggest that Meta knew exactly how addictive not only Instagram but its other tools are on a regular basis and does not disclose that information to its audience.
Well, this is a case we'll have to just keep following. But this is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I wanted to move on to astronaut phones because NASA recently announced that astronauts are able to take modern phones into orbit. And first of all, I guess, I don't know, that surprised me. Were they not allowed to take their phones before, or was there no point? Was there like no point because they just simply wouldn't work?
Yeah, so I mean, some of these answers are quite generational. If you talk, as far back as Apollo astronauts, that they had, specific, kind of custom, modified cameras that could be brought on board that would not be damaged by things like solar radiation as they left the atmosphere. Which has been, kind of an ongoing concern, is that, the once you leave Earth's atmosphere, there are quite a bit in the way of, electronics that can be interrupted by either solar emissions or, kind of other communication tools from satellites that are already in orbit. There is a lot that goes into that. But there have been tests over the last year. There was a SpaceX mission earlier this month that had four astronauts that went up to the International Space Station. And they were allowed to bring consumer level phones with them on that journey. This is the first time that an iPhone has been tested and qualified. It is NASA did not say that iPhones were the only ones that could go, but they did not release a full list of like phone brands that have been cleared for this kind of travel. But the idea is that the cameras on these and the tech that goes into building the shuttles are now such that that radiation is not an issue.
So when Katy Perry and company went up into space, they didn't have their phones with them?
Fun fact, they did not go into space,
Okay.
but yes, they
Well,
did not have there was professional equipment that went in there as they reached high orbit. Yeah,
yeah.
there were no like personal phones that that captured those moments. Those were things that were done with other cameras. But also the this is a lot more to do with that technology lasting for an extended period of time on the ISS and less about like an individual journey.
Okay. So is this more about the phone though, or this is because you keep mentioning the camera. This is more about the camera than the actual like making a phone call from space.
It's a combination, so some of it is making sure that the battery tech is, something that isn't going to potentially rupture, because, fire is one of the worst things that you can have in space. So, having something that is going to be safe and durable. I imagine that there's probably a special protective case that these phones are in, but NASA hasn't explicitly stated that yet. But there's yeah, the camera being able to capture things in such a way that solar radiation doesn't immediately destroy the sensor on the inside is another reason that we previously were using quite custom lenses on cameras to take pictures as even as far back as the 60s.
Okay. Well, before we run out of time, whether or not this phone is in space or not doesn't matter. There's a new phone from Google. It's the Pixel 10a. What are the specs of this new phone? Are you excited about this new Google Pixel?
Yeah, so every year we get to springtime and Google takes the very fancy phone that they released in the fall and they release a budget version of it in the spring. And that is very much what you're seeing here. The Google's Pixel 10a, one of the first things that I noticed when looking at it, and it just may be that I'm a phone weirdo, and so other people won't notice this at first. It's perfectly flat on the back. There is no great big bulge where the camera goes, which is something that Apple and Google both have struggled with for quite some time now, in having a phone that actually lays flat when you put it down. And so this is a new design from Google, and it's not clear if this is a design that's going to continue into, their much fancier versions. But this is a phone that has a battery that is quite a bit larger than its predecessor. The camera on it appears to be really nice, although we haven't finished our complete suite of testing on it yet. But more importantly, is it charges almost twice as fast as its predecessor. It has a very special piece of equipment in it that a lot of higher end phones have, but a lot of budget phones don't, because it's kind of expensive in the way that it regulates power and allows the battery to charge much faster if you have a larger charger to plug into it. So if you had like your laptop charger or a really nice car charger, you would be able to get 80% of your battery charged in a couple of minutes if it were completely dead. But then that last 20% takes quite a bit longer because it kind of slow charges in order to make sure that that battery life lasts a good long while.
So this is supposed to be, because it has the A with it, Google Pixel 10a, it's supposed to be cost saving. So how much does it cost?
This is going to start at 500, which is right around half what Google's high-end versions of these phones tend to cost. And then there, if you want more storage, there is a 128 gigabyte model, which is the kind of base model, and there's a 256 gigabyte model that is $100 more.
Okay.
So if you take a lot of pictures and you require and you record a lot of video, you probably want the slightly more expensive one. But you know, this is, you know, we've seen several companies do versions of this over the last couple of years, and it's been very, very popular to have, you know, these kind of budget versions of these nicer phones that, you know, are not costing, you know, between $1,000 and $1,500 for you to own.
I thought the colors they offered it in were very pretty, though, that they were
I'm
nice.
always excited by fun colors,
Yeah.
and Google and Apple both have been kind of trading back and forth on which company is doing the coolest colors. These are very bright primary colors, which is really great. They're also releasing as a part of its launch clear cases so that you can actually see
See the
those
colors.
colors.
That's what gets me. I like the color of the phone, but then I have to put a case on it.
Exactly.
Thank you for joining us today, Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich.
Gavin News. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.